Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, now, I've got to say, you've accused me of being nice about you just off air. I don't want to, you know, start any rumours here. I have been saying some nice things, but it's been with a purpose, Jem, and that purpose is pushing something very specific.
Do tell!
Well, this is because you've actually been working, Jem, which I know is normally frowned upon on this podcast. You've actually been pushing to try and get us into the, now I'm going to get this right, British Podcast Awards, is that correct?
That's absolutely right. So I found out about these about a week ago, and the fact that it's UK only means that we're not competing against some of the really big American podcasts. But yes, so what we want people to do is if you go on to the British Podcast Awards, see, it's really easy, britishpodcastawards.com/vote, or if you just do a search for it. It then asks you what podcast you want to nominate. So all you have to do is type in Condensed History Gems, and it pops up as if by magic. And as you said, and I said as well, look, let's be realistic, guys. We ain't going to win. But wouldn't it be great if we could get this podcast, which we've been working so hard for about a year and a half now, wouldn't it be great to at least be nominated? It would really elevate us, might give us the opportunity, catch the eye of a sponsor, means that we would get sort of better quality podcasts out for you. And also, I just don't want to see, as I said in the Fast Five, I just don't want to see a list of podcasts which are apparently all about fashion, makeup, and music. Those things are fine, but you know what? There's some really good podcasts about other things, and let's get some history in there, shall we?
And I think one of the important things here is that you said how easy it is to do. You just go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. And I point out again how easy that was, because this afternoon I recorded one of my messages from the road for over on my video channel, and I wanted to make sure I plugged the website where people could go and do that, the britishpodcastawards.com/vote, which I kind of got ready and I typed it in, you know, I read it and I was just leaving to go and record it, and flick, my other half said, well, Greg, what was that website again? And I said, it's Podcast Award. Took me about four attempts to get out the door before I'd actually figured it out. So I will include a link below this episode as well. Wherever you're downloading it, we will have the information written down if you do forget it. But, Jem, I'll tell you what, we're not actually just here to try and win awards or anything else like that. I think we're actually here to talk about history.
We are indeed. And actually, this was a request. After putting on Twitter the thing about the awards, I actually had this gentleman from America saying, look, I've actually been listening to you guys pretty much since the beginning, which is really flattering. And we sort of went backwards and forwards a little bit. And I then said, any requests? And he came up with a really good one. He said, the Habsburgs. And I sort of went, oh, you know, we'll definitely think about that. Now it's been a turnaround less than a week. But it just sort of made me think, do you know what? If there's a dynasty that kind of summarizes Western European history, it's got to be the Habsburgs. Now, you know, it's almost like, well, which bit do you want to talk about? Because it's all over the place. I'm going to start off with a little question for you, Greg. I have been looking around for this. There is only one major title that the Habsburgs didn't have. Obviously, the family itself had split into different groups and so on and so forth. But can you guess what's the one major title they never technically had?
Miss America.
You're right. You are right. They were, no, yes, they had terrible chins for starters. A lot of them had really big chins. So they were never going to win Miss America. But European aristocracy, going to guess?
It's going to be king or queen of somewhere.
You're right.
Oh, gosh. Is this going to be like a trip one? Because they did Habsburg, they did Austria. Were they never king and queen of Germany or something?
No. Well, there was the Emperor of Germany, and they were indeed that. But no, the answer is France, King of France or Queen of France, because technically, when Queen Mary the First of England, she married Philip First or Second, I can't remember off the top of my head, but Philip of Spain, he was a Habsburg. So briefly, they could claim to be kings of England as well. They never actually ruled in any meaningful way, so they managed to do all of Europe, apart from France. And indeed, France was the main enemy of the Habsburgs in the West. In the East, the Habsburgs keep cropping up whenever you do Ottoman history, because they were fighting against the Ottomans in the East. And so what that led to is really counterintuitively more than 100 years of alliances between France and the Ottoman Empire, because sandwiched in between those two territories were the Habsburgs' lands.
And just to kind of, you've kind of started this with, who are they not rulers of? But I've just got a little list here in front of me of some of the titles that were held by the Habsburgs.
Excellent. So that's going to use up most of the rest of the podcast. Off you go, Greg.
So, the obvious ones, you're a King of Spain, Holy Roman Emperor, King of the Romans, King of Germany, King of Italy. And then we get down to King of Castile, King of Aragon, King of Valencia, King of Mallorca, King of Sicily, King of Naples, King of Hungary, King of Jerusalem, King of Bohemia, King of Croatia, King of Portugal. I mean, half of these places I would not have thought of as, you know, if you ask me to list places in Europe, I'm going to struggle to get a lot of places. Grand Prince of Transylvania, Archduke of Austria, Emperor of Mexico. I mean, Duke of Burgundy and Duke of Parma. I mean, that's before you get even to being Count of Habsburg in the first place. That's my quick fire list of just how far they were spread.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so when you get a list like that, you realize, in a way, they are continental European history, in a way. Pretty much everything after 1500 in Europe was either for them or trying to stop them.
Yeah, exactly. So where does this take us? How do we, you know, while we're talking about this subject, we've got a huge subject here. How do we nail this something down that we can talk about in a 20-minute podcast?
Well, I just thought we would sort of meander around them a little bit. But I wanted to talk briefly about the chunk of the Habsburgs that are the most relevant or to where we are today, and that's the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, most people have heard about that because that's pivotal to understanding the causes of World War One. But the weird thing is, obviously, things like the Holy Roman Empire had been going on, you know, since the Middle Ages, but actually Austro-Hungary was created in 1867, and it was dismantled at the end of World War One. That's 1918. So it lasted 51 years, and 49 of those years was ruled by Franz Joseph. Now, it isn't the shortest running empire in history. People tend to forget that Alexander the Great was very impressive, but pretty much as soon as he died, his empire collapsed. So it lasted 10 years, as it were. But it's weird to think that an empire that lasted a little over half a century was basically ruled by one emperor. That's what it was. And you know, somebody born in 1867 is more than likely to be alive in 1918, and then they see the end of this empire. So it's one of these things where you think it's been around longer than it has been. Obviously, it's the remnants of the Holy Roman Empire, but it's one of these things which isn't as old as you think it is. And just one last thing on that, of course, the other pivotal thing there, I mentioned World War One, but it was the key member of the family, Franz Joseph's direct descendant, the Archduke Ferdinand, who was assassinated in Serbia, and you know, hence the trigger of World War One. So you've got this very old family, this family that has been power playing across Europe for centuries, being the trigger of a very modern war.
And we call it the trigger, but part of the reason that assassination did trigger, as it were, World War One is because of that complex system of alliances that existed across Europe at that time. And that is why all the different countries across Europe got pulled into what, let's be honest, was a minor territorial scuffle in that area of the Balkans, and suddenly expanded to encompass the whole world. Well, as we found out a few weeks ago, you know, it sort of spread right across to America a little bit later on. But that initial powder keg, I think, is a term usually used, that set fire to Europe. That is because of all the treaties and because of all the interconnections between the countries, because a lot of the royalty were related in different ways. And part of that has to come down to the fact that the Habsburgs had spread everywhere. And that is why we have so much interrelationship between the royals in that period.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth sort of pausing for a moment and say, you know, when you look at the dynasties of Europe, they all intermarried. The amount, you know, we tend to think in Britain, oh, you know, we hate the French, but the amount of English kings who had French mothers is sort of ridiculous, quite frankly. So they were all interrelated. I once looked at the list of people who are potentially the next step on the throne of, you know, Queen Elizabeth II, if she was to die and, you know, family was to, you know, immediate family was to be wiped out in a plane crash or something. Who would get it? And pretty quickly you get into things like the Dutch royal family. Now, they're not the immediate choice, as it were. But the one of the weird things is some of the famous dynasties, particularly of Britain, didn't last that long. The Tudors, everybody's heard the Tudors. They lasted about a century, little bit over. But the Habsburgs, they just kept popping up in all these different places. You mentioned Emperor of Mexico. Well, of course, the reason why they were Emperor of Mexico was because they were King of Spain, and Spain expanded their empire into the Americas. But you've got this amazing spread of power, different arms of the family sometimes arguing against each other and fighting against each other. And, well, in theory, they had the Habsburgs. They sound German. And, you know, obviously, originally they were. But I've got this absolutely marvelous quote here from Charles V, who was a Holy Roman Emperor, you know, sort of in the Renaissance era. And this kind of summarizes the complexity of the languages and cultures and relationships. He said, and I quote, "I speak Spanish to God, Italian to women, French to men, and German to my horse." So he's, you know, he's quite quotable.
Okay, well, you've gone for a quotation. I was going for a quotation as well, but I must admit mine was far less poetical and refined than that. I was just thinking when we were talking about the interbreeding in Europe, and especially as it relates to World War One, my mind immediately went, of course, as it so often does, to Blackadder. And
of course,
and the wonderful moment where Captain Darling tries to convince Blackadder that he's not a spy, and he says, "I'm as British as Queen Victoria." And of course, Blackadder turns around and says, "So your father's German, you're half German, and you married a German." And it's that point when we think about this was the war in Europe, and it came down to, yeah, really at the top, the royal families were families having a little bit of a feud that boils down to the people across Europe.
Yes, I know we're kind of going slightly off the Habsburgs, but when you look at the outbreak of World War One, the British Emperor, as he was technically known, the Kaiser and the Tsar, they were all cousins, and they did actually discuss, you know, there could be a looming war. Maybe we shouldn't do this. But what was interesting is by then, if you like, politics was overtaking the family connections. Someone like Tsar Nicholas, he was an absolute ruler, so he could slow things down. But the Kaiser wasn't quite as autocratic as I think he wanted to be, and certainly the British Emperor by then was just merely a figurehead. So it was interesting how they would, you know, if this had been a conversation 500 years earlier, they absolutely would have been able to stop everything or declare war. And it's also worth remembering that in these times, just because people were related didn't in any way slow them down trying to kill each other. But the problem there was they were trying to use the old-fashioned way of communication in an age where that just wasn't how politics was done anymore.
And one thing I'm just going to say, I believe it was at Pinstripe Boy who actually, I've been going back, who actually suggested to you that we do the Habsburgs. And you kind of said there, we seem to be going slightly off the topic of the Habsburgs. Well, what I will say is this has been suggested to us by somebody who's listened to us right from the beginning, Jem. And so, really, they should know full well by this point in time, you know, a year and a half in the podcast, that what we start talking about at the beginning is nowhere near what we're going to end up talking about when the podcast episode finishes. And so
that is true. I mean, it's a good job you've had dinner. Otherwise, you would understand this would have turned into like, so what did the Habsburgs eat?
Actually, I haven't had dinner yet. I'm starving. Let's see. Germany, Austria-Hungary. I mean, you've not got a best coast. Probably wasn't. Anyway, that's not the point, Jim. Let's try and stick vaguely towards history. So that's kind of where we end up. But my question for you about the Habsburgs is, how do we get started with them? Because by the time they spread out and they're all across Europe, we can see the power and we can see how it spread. How did this family start to gain this power base across Europe?
Well, the thing about the Holy Roman Empire, as the joke goes, it wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't much of an empire. But apart from that, it's a good name. And the thing is that the Holy Roman Empire was a system to control all these different duchies and principalities, which we would now call sort of Germany, bits of Switzerland, bits of northern Italy, and mainly Austria as well. Now, interestingly, Austria in German is Österreich, which is the East Lands. And the reason that was called that was it was seen as the buffer between Christian Western Europe and Ottoman lands. So anyway, I'm slightly digressing. So the point is, the Holy Roman Empire, it didn't necessarily go father son, and the Habsburgs were just lucky. If you trace it right back to the beginning, we're talking about tiny little princelings who just maneuvered and just happened to survive longer than the other ones. That, you know, it wasn't like there was never a William the Conqueror moment where they just happened to explode out of nowhere and take over all the lands. They just played the political game until they had reached the top of the heap. And really, it's once you get to the kind of sort of 1500s onwards, that's when they, you know, this is why I keep mentioning the Renaissance. It's kind of, sort of in the true Middle Ages, they were around, but they weren't one of the power players of Europe. But certainly once we get to 1500, 1600, now we have a very big family fighting, and obviously because if we mentioned the King of Spain, that was through marriage and integration, and obviously at the very end of the 1400s, the whole of the Iberian Peninsula had become a Christian kingdom again, which meant that for a lot of that time they weren't that desirable. You know, in 1300, who wanted to marry the King of Castile? He owned very small amounts of lands, was pretty poor, and up against a massive Islamic empire of the Moors. So in that stage, if the Habsburgs were to get involved, or any dynasty was to get involved, it shows you that they were very minor players, because the King of England would not let his daughter marry somebody like the King of Castile. It was beneath that sort of pecking order. So the Habsburgs are an example of playing very much the long game in history.
Yeah, and they did play the long game, because I don't know if you can answer this question straight off the top of your head, Jim. I do have the answer for you. If not, do you know when the Habsburg dynasty died out as a royal dynasty?
I'm pretty sure there's a whole bunch of Habsburgs still alive.
But as a royal dynasty, you see, that I was careful with my question there.
As a royal dynasty, I'm going to say, well, perhaps 1918?
Well, technically, it died out as a royal dynasty in 2011.
Of course it did. Go on, why? Why? This is a good little fact.
The death of Otto von Habsburg. And Otto von Habsburg was the oldest son of the last Austro-Hungarian emperor. But he actually renounced in the 60s. He renounced all claim to the Austrian throne. And so he was the last one that was actually considered royal. And from that point on, he wasn't a royalty, but he was the last member of the dynasty that had any sort of royal connections. And so on his death, he still had a fairly elaborate funeral. We're talking, you know, 640 years after the Habsburgs first sort of started to come to power. 640 years later, the last member of the dynasty to have any sort of royalty, he was buried in Austria. Well, most of him was buried in Austria. he was buried in Austria with the exception of his heart. And his heart was taken away, and that was actually buried in a crypt in Hungary, which, you know, seems like a strange way to go, but it was part of a tradition, and I just think it's incredible that this history, this line, this family runs right through, ends up with somebody who's renounced everything, essentially. He said, no, you know, that's the royalty's over, we're going back to... Essentially, he was the person that said, no, we're going back and we're going to be a normal family now, as it were. And basically, they have gone on. As you say, they're all over the place. You know, there will be descendants of the Habsburgs, but the empire, everything they built up as a ruling family of Europe, that side of it is now gone.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that's worth sort of differentiating them from, say, their northern German cousins, who are very much Protestant, is they were very, very Catholic, which was another reason why they were connected with Spain and Italy, and they could get the backing of the Pope as well. And during the 30 Years' War, which we occasionally mention, this incredible maelstrom of violence, mainly in Central Europe from 1618 to 1648, they were very much sort of fighting the Protestant powers of the time. Although right at the end of that war, France got involved, who was also very Catholic, which is another example of France and the Habsburgs sort of slugging it out. But the other reason I keep sort of mentioning this, because, you know, the weird thing about the Habsburgs is you can very much look to the West and you can very much look to the East. You can't get much more further west from the perspective of Europe than Mexico, for starters. But, you know, in the East... You know, the capital of the Habsburg power of the Germanic part of the family was Vienna, and Vienna was besieged not once but twice, separated by about 100 years by the Ottoman Empire. Now, on both occasions, the Ottomans came within a hair's breadth. The second one, in particular, was a very, very close run thing, but the Habsburgs managed to push back the tide. However, it does show you how vulnerable their capital city was to a completely aggressive alien empire to theirs. I mean, if you think about Moscow, for example, it's not exactly near any enemies. Or if you're looking at Paris, it's not exactly near the borders of France. So it does show you how very much on the frontiers of Christian Europe the Habsburgs were for a very long time. It's also worth mentioning that in this second siege, which happened in the late 1600s, the Holy Roman Emperor of the time, I can't remember his name, but he very nobly ran away from Vienna and allowed his generals to do their best to defend it. And then when they won, and the main attack that pushed back the Ottoman forces was actually the Polish king and his sort of lancers. It was one of the largest cavalry charges in recorded history. So if you like, that guy got the credit rather than the Habsburg himself. But, you know, obviously he probably made sure there's a nice statue of himself in Vienna. One last thing about that second siege of Vienna is immediately afterwards, one of the bakers in Vienna wanted to commemorate this in some way. First of all, the siege rations had lifted, so let's actually enjoy ourselves. And the symbol of the Ottoman Empire is the crescent. If you think of the modern day, a lot of modern day Islamic countries have the crescent and star. So this Viennese baker made little crescent-shaped pastries, the croissant. The croissant is not French. It was invented in Vienna, in Austria, to commemorate the victory over the Ottomans.
And as you are the one that accused me of turning the podcast round to food, and then you bring up the croissant, Jim, I think that's rather unfair.
Well, I think it's a good fact, okay?
I do like your fact, but we're going to have to move quickly away from fact to fiction. So before we move on to our What If Gem, do you have anything else you want to add for this particular episode?
No, I think I'm pretty much done, except to say, don't forget to look at the link at the end of the details of the podcast. Sorry, I'll get my teeth in again. In the details underneath the podcast, you'll find access to the British Podcast Awards. Don't forget to vote, people.
There you go. That's my. How did that sound in terms of the professional voice
that
thing, Greg? Did that
very
work?
Very radio voice. I like that. Be careful, though, because we don't want to sound too professional and take away our edge as the little guys vying for the title. Okay, Jim. Well, let's leave the Habsburgs there, and no doubt people will suggest different things we can come back to. But thank you. We do love listener suggestions. We do love all of you guys getting involved on Twitter, giving us suggestions of what we should talk about. But, Jim, it's that time.
So we are now into the wonderful world of what ifs. Greg has no idea what I'm going to ask him. It's a piece. It's a chance for a little bit of counterfactual history. And it's a simple one today. What if Julius Caesar died during his Gallic campaigns? Now, just very, very brief bit of background for people who don't know. Julius Caesar is obviously one of the most famous people in history, but actually he made his name in Rome by fighting and conquering Gaul, which is France. But he fought in lots of battles. It's not unreasonable to think maybe at some point he might have ended up with an axe in the head. So that all happened just before he went back to Rome and declared himself dictator. So it would have completely changed our understanding of Julius Caesar. He would have been a very minor noble who happened to die in a battle. But what do you think would be the consequences, the echoes of him dying before his time?
Okay, I think if Julius Caesar had died much, much earlier, for the first thing, we probably wouldn't know his name, not in anywhere near the same level that we know it. You know, sort of every school child knows the name Julius Caesar. They don't necessarily all know the name of Vespasian, for example, or any of the other emperors, let alone just soldiers and people who are out on the battlefield fighting. So I think we'd have lost that crucial bit of history with him. Another thing, you know, certain phrases, beware the Ides of March. Now, that is from, you know, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Shakespeare, fabulous playwright. He would have lost one of his best plays. And I think this is what it comes down to. Julius Caesar, he was triumphant. He invented this whole, you know, he took this whole position of emperor. He created an empire that built it around him. Basically, he was somebody who knew what it was to be appreciated and to build accolades. And I think if Julius Caesar had died earlier on, perhaps we wouldn't have had quite so much in the way of triumphs and things like that in the Roman era. We might not have had all the great big triumphal arches, not as many as we had. I mean, Julius Caesar, he knew how to celebrate. He knew how to grab an award and hold on to it. And if Julius Caesar had been around today, I'll tell you what, Jim, if Julius Caesar had been around today, he would be telling people to go to BritishPodcastAwards.com and vote for the Julius Caesar podcast, but he's not. So you can go ahead and carry on voting for the Condensed History Gems podcast. I've completely lost track of the what if because I suddenly saw an opportunity to squeeze in one final plug for the podcast awards. So, Jim, I'm afraid my answer made no sense. But
it started well. It didn't necessarily end well, but it started very well. I think we can all agree on that.
I think that's pretty much the story of the what ifs. So that does roughly bring us to the end of the episode. Jim, just is there anything you want to plug today?
Do you really want me to do it again? Guys, seriously, you know, we're not asking for any money. We're not asking really for any of your time. This will take you about 15 seconds. All you need is a valid email account to write it in. And you know what? If you really like us, why not use your personal email and your work email? You can vote for us twice. That'd be lovely. But it would be absolutely wonderful if we could get nominated.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you so much for listening. And again, this episode, the initial subject we started from and pretty much stuck to, more or less.
I think we largely stuck to it.
Was a suggestion from a listener, and please do tweet us with any other suggestions. We, you know, we are particularly keen. Obviously, we want you to listen. We want you to enjoy. We'll keep coming up with ideas, but if you have anything in particular you want us to talk about, then do shout. Give me or Jem a shout on Twitter. Our Twitter links are in the feed below here as well. But for now, we're running out of time, so it only remains for me to say thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And that's all from us. So have a great week. Goodbye. Vote for us at BritishPodcastAwards.com/vote. And take care.